Today's Taisho will be on case 30 in the Mumonkan, the Umenkwan, the Gate of No Barrier. Case 30 is entitled Basso's This Very Mind is the Buddha. Dai Bai asked Basso, "What is the Buddha?" Basso answered, "This very mind is the Buddha." Mumon's comment, "If you directly grasp Basso's meaning, you wear the Buddha's clothes, eat the Buddha's food, speak the Buddha's words, do the Buddha's deeds. That is, you are the Buddha himself." However, alas, Dai Bai misled not a few people into taking the mark on the scale for the weight itself. How could he realize that even mentioning the word Buddha should make us rinse out our mouths for 3 days? If a man of understanding hears someone say, "This very mind is the Buddha," he will cover his ears and rush away. Mumon's verse, "The blue sky and bright day, no more searching around. What is the Buddha, you ask? With loot in your pocket, you declare yourself innocent." Thank you so much for coming to practice Zen this morning. It's easy to misunderstand Zen practice. It's easy to misunderstand Zen practice. Many people do. We have beginners' evenings, especially Friday night. And new people come here, and I'm not always sure that, I'm pretty sure they don't know what to expect. When I was growing up, my father was in the military, and we moved around from one base to another, one naval base to another, and I was often very bored on these military bases. And I developed a habit of reading, which was really a great thing. And I developed a very active fantasy life. One of the things that I loved to do in the afternoon was to go to the library on the base and look at old National Geographics. And I used to look at National Geographics, and often I would spend the whole afternoon just entranced by these photographs and stories of faraway places. And I remember being particularly interested in the photographs and stories of Tibet and the Buddhist world. Maybe that's why I got interested in Buddhism. The pictures of Bhutan or the Potala Palace in Tibet were just so inspiring and mysterious to me. Or National Geographic would have stories on Japanese monasteries also, like Eheiji in Fukui Prefecture. Eheiji is this ancient complex of temples. And it's in a grove of ancient trees, and there's stairways made of stone leading up to the main temple. So you walk up these ancient stones through this deep forest to this beautiful, beautiful Japanese temple. It's like an enchanted world, And I would just dream of what it must be like to be a monk in one of those temples, And they were so different from the world I grew up with. in the 1960s United States, in 1970s United States. I would not say that the world I grew up in was mysterious or beautiful. You know, it wasn't terrible, but pretty much I would go to school in a building that, was a brick, modern brick building. We would go to the store and buy food and come home and watch TV. That was sort of my life. And, my life was sort of boring. On the base, there was really nothing to do. You could play baseball in the afternoon, but we couldn't really leave the base, easily. I should also say that, military bases are not really that nice a place to live for other reasons, too. You know, you have all of these, at that time, it was mostly a male world, and you have a lot of screwed up guys. There's a lot of alcoholism. Some violence, so it's just not a happy world. And it's boring and uninteresting. And also, there were other things too, when I was growing up, I remember we used to be, in school, we used to have drills for nuclear attack. So we would all do the, we would all get up and form rows in front of our desks and crouch down on the floor preparing for a nuclear attack. So this was sort of the world I was growing up in. We were perhaps going to go to war with the Russians. I was living on these military bases that were unhappy places in a lot of ways. And I would read these books or these National Geographic magazines on Tibet and Japan. And I formed this image of the Asian world as this very exotic, very enlightened place. And this was a good thing and a bad thing, because on the one hand, it inspired me. I think it's the reason I got interested in Zen. But on the other hand, it made this world of enlightenment very remote, very far from the world I lived in, So I it was sort of a dream world for me, and it was very, very distant from the world I actually lived in. I finished high school, and I went to a university, and I went through 4 years of college. And when I got out of college, I was living in Seattle, and I just happened to run into a Japanese monk. And it triggered all these associations with the mysterious National Geographics I had read. And I was so intrigued by the thought of doing Zen practice that I jumped right into it. It was really exciting to me, but it seemed very mysterious. I was waiting for, this is going to sound so silly, but I had the feeling that in those monasteries, they did very mysterious and special things. When the Tibetan monks came to Rutgers about 5 years ago, they did a sand painting, And a sand painting is what I would have imagined monks did, So I would have guessed that behind closed doors, they had mysterious rituals and imparted mysterious teachings that only like people who were special or specially prepared could hear. That sounds maybe silly, but I really believed that. I thought they had mysterious teachings. People have actually asked me the question, believe it or not, people have actually asked me the question, can Zen monks fly? I'm not kidding. I have actually been asked that question in honesty. Can they fly? And I myself, when I was young, probably would have thought that they could fly. I mean, there's a lot of fantasy in all of this. When I was growing up, there was a writer whose name was Lobsang Rampa, who sold millions of books on Tibet, and he had never been to Tibet. But he told these stories about Tibet, and he said that Tibetan monks could communicate telepathically. And in his books, they can travel long distances on these kites. These were huge bestsellers. Many people in the West got their introduction to Asian culture through Lobsang Rampa, who was not a lama at all and wasn't even Asian. But, you know, I had this image of this world where, you know, monks could communicate telepathically and they had mysterious powers and maybe they could fly, but they didn't do it in front of everybody, you know. So I had a lot of fantasy about, and I think we all have, everybody who gets interested in Zen or religion in general, you know, there's a lot of fantasy in that, you know. The idea that somebody could fly or walk on water, these are really, you know, powerful dreams we have, you know. This is a good thing in a certain way because they inspire us, right? It's inspiring. I'm pretty sure the reason I became Genki Roshi's student was that I had read these National Geographics and I thought maybe I can go up those stone stairs and enter that secret temple and my life will be so much better. You know, I was kind of an unhappy kid. I grew up in sort of an unhappy world, I would say. And, you know, dreaming of, you know, Tibet or dreaming of Japan meant to me that the world could be better. I could be happier. And I had the feeling that, you know, up those stone stairs and in that temple, people knew how to be happy. And so when I studied with Genki Roshi, I really thought I was going to go to that world, that mysterious world. And for a while, I was waiting for, like, the secret initiation. This might sound silly, but I was really waiting for this, you know. So when Genki Roshi arrived in the United States, it was 1977. And, Seattle was like a hippie town at that time. It was like a counterculture town. So it was filled with young people who were part of, like, the late 60s, early 70s scene. And when they heard that this Japanese monk had come from Japan, a Zen master, you know, the first time he held meditation, I think like 50 people showed up. And we had a group, we quickly formed a group, the Seattle Zen Center. And we began to do Zen practice, serious Zen practice. We would sit at the university a couple nights a week, just as our group does. And we would have Saturday sits like this, and then we would do sesshin, just as we do sesshin. And, I went to an introductory class, and Webb Sensei, the assistant to Genki Roshi, taught everybody how to breathe through the dantian, and so on. And then I began to go to sesshin, and I began to go into Dokusan and meet the Roshi. And Dokusan, for those of you who have been to sesshin, know is a chance where you can meet privately with the teacher and talk about your practice. And I can remember waiting to go to see Genki Roshi with great anticipation, you know, basically sitting in line, meditating, and waiting for my turn to go into the room, and I would sit down in front of him, and in my fantasies, you know, I thought maybe he would impart, like, secret teachings to me. And he would tell me something or give me some ritual I could do that would make me less unhappy, you know. And did I believe this literally? Probably. You know, but certainly, in sort of my fantasy mind, I definitely thought it would be like this. So, you know, I didn't think I would fly, but I did think that I would go into that room with Genki Roshi and he would give me a ritual or give me something that would really, like, transform my consciousness. And by the way, you know, even though it might sound ridiculous that people can fly, when I was a college student, very popular series of books were called The Yaqui Way of Knowledge by an anthropologist named Carlos Castaneda. And these books were probably not real. They were probably like Lobsang Rampa. But they were extremely popular, and many people thought they were actually ethnographies, respectable ethnographies. And I read them avidly. And by the way, in those books, people can fly. At the end of one of the books, the American student of this Native American shaman, they step off a cliff together and fly through the air. So I was ready for almost anything when I went to see Genki Roshi. But you know, he didn't give me any secret teachings. He didn't give me any secret teachings. I went in to see him, and he said, "What's happening with your breath?" And I said, "Well, you know, I'm breathing, you know, breathing in and out." And he said, "Okay." He said, "When you breathe out, what happens?" "I don't know, nothing." He said, "Okay, good." And he rang the bell, and that was the end of the interview. So I felt, you know, I thought this is a test, right? The secret teachings are coming, you know? It's a test. You know, I was waiting for the secret way of knowledge, right? Like Castaneda. And by the way, I went to Mexico for 6 months looking for Don Juan, and I didn't find him. So you know, I kept practicing Zen, and I would go in to see Genki Roshi, and he'd say, "What's happening with your breath?" And I would just say, "I'm, you know, breath goes in, breath goes out, you know." And as we would go on with this, you know, sort of charade, I felt like he was testing me to see if I was going to be an obedient student. But I began to grow impatient. I began to feel like, "Will you cut? You know, let's cut to the chase. You know, give me the real teachings." Now, this is how I was, you know. So you know, I just felt like this was for babies. You know, watching your breath. Come on, give me the real koan, the real teachings. And so, you know, basically I was working on the breath for years with Genki Roshi. I didn't quit because when I began to do meditation, I began to feel better, you know. So I would sit down on the cushion, and I would be, you know, not feeling, a little depressed. I think I was probably a little depressed. And I was under a lot of stress. I had started graduate school, and I felt really unprepared for graduate school, because I had taken several years off looking for Don Juan and doing things like that, and so my mind was not really well-trained. And I was with a lot of people who were very well-educated, who spoke multiple languages, and so I felt overwhelmed, and I was a little depressed. And when I would come in to do meditation, I would sit down on the cushion. When I would get off the cushion, I wouldn't think about it, but I realize now, in retrospect, that I felt better. It was a therapeutic for me. It made me feel better. And I would get off the cushion and I could go through the day a little bit happier and a little bit less fearful and locked up. But, you know, I really didn't appreciate this at the time because I kept thinking that I was... I kept thinking the Roshi wasn't sharing the secrets with me. You know, he wasn't sharing. And I also began to think that I was failing at Zen practice, you know. So after a while, I would go in to see Genki, and I would try to say things that were profound, you know. I would try to say, you know, I would come in to see him, and he'd say, "How's your breath?" And I would say, "It's all one. It's all one." And he'd say, "Yes, but what's happening with your breath?" You know, and he'd ring the bell, and the interview was over. So, you know, I actually had to stay with the breath koan for many years, actually, because I was looking for something other than the moment. You know, I was looking for something other than the moment. The Roshi wanted me to pay attention to the moment. What's happening right now when you watch your breath? You know, we think we understand the breath, right? We breathe all the time. And, you know, you study respiration in, like, seventh grade biology class, which is all I remember of biology. But, you know, the O2 goes in and the CO2 goes out. And you think, I understand the breath. But, you know, we really don't understand the breath. If you sit quietly for many hours observing your breath, it can open up a whole new world to you. The most extraordinary world. You know, Zen is all about direct experience. You know, we live in a world of culture. You know, we live in culture. You know, we can't help it. World of symbols, a forest of symbols, words, all of these assumptions. And, you know, the Buddhist view or the Zen view is that actually all of this stuff gets in the way. You know, our culture is really not like a trustworthy guide to enlightenment. It's not particularly a happy place. You know, the values of our society are not very healthy values. But we're sort of trapped in all of these assumptions about reality and about liberation. You know, so when you do Zen practice, you know, the goal of Zen practice is really like to work through all of this junk, cut through all of these veils of assumption and cultural discourse. And for a little, sometimes it's possible to just sort of push all of this stuff aside and encounter the breath in a fresh way, or encounter the object of your attention in a fresh way. So you're watching the breath, and waiting for some great revelation to happen. And meanwhile, I'm not really paying attention to the breath. You know, if you watch the breath, at first you think you know what the breath is, you know. But if you keep watching the breath, it begins to do all kinds of strange things. So, you know, if you're really focused on the breath, you might notice it doesn't seem to be going out your nose. It might seem to be going out your head. Or it might disappear altogether, you know, if you're actually just observing what's happening. If you can stay with the experience of the breath, it's very different from what your preconceptions tell you. You know, actually, if you focus intensely on anything, it disappears after a while. You'll find not only can you not focus on it, but your mind actually goes blank. Now, you might think that's trivial, but it's actually quite important in understanding what reality is and who we are. You know, so it seems so trivial to watch the breath. And I just thought, this is for beginners. I'm not a beginner. Give me the secret teachings. And I just couldn't understand that the teacher was asking me to approach the moment with a fresh mind, a beginner's mind, as we say in Zen. And I'd come in and say, it's all one, you know, or I'd say, it's death and life, you know. And, you know, he would just ring the bell. He's such a kind guy, you know. I'm amazed he didn't laugh at me or something. He would just say, keep going, you know, keep going. And he would give me little hints. He'd say, well, when you get to the end of the breath, what happens? You know, and it's very hard for me to pay attention. You know, I was reading Heidegger in my graduate courses, you know, and I thought, this is being, you know. So I was making it worse, right? I was surrounding it with all these concepts. And so one way to think of Zen practice is that, you know, we're sitting down on the cushion and we're encountering the moment. And we're sort of working through all of these assumptions. And we have these moments where we can actually sort of like push everything aside. And for a minute, we get a fresh glimpse. We get a fresh glimpse. It's often the case that once we have that glimpse, it closes up on us again. You know, humans secrete symbols and ideas and metaphors and so on the way oysters secrete shell, you know, to protect themselves. So, you know, we do bump into reality and then we immediately start secreting all of this stuff around it to distance ourselves. But then we feel sad because we're cut off, you know. This is like the human condition. So, you know, every once in a while, though, we cut through. You know, we cut through and we experience like the breath in itself. And it's at that moment the boundary between ourselves and the world disappears. You know, it disappears. And you become the breath. You know, you become your breath. You're not watching. At first, you're trying to watch the breath. Then, you know, you're trying to watch the breath. You begin to be with the breath, but sort of at a distance. And at some point, that distance collapses, and you simply become one with your breath. And then you might notice that the breath is taking you to this place you didn't expect. It's not Tibet. That's the hint. Okay? It's not taking you to Tibet, but it's taking you somewhere important if you can just look. So it was very hard for me to be in the moment. You know, it was very hard for me to be with the breath. You know, I kept trying to attach significance or to have an experience that would be like an earth-shattering experience of revelation and so I kept missing what was really liberating about this moment, you know. And this process went on for a long time, you know. It was a little bit difficult for me because, when I was in high school, I was one of these students who was obsessive about getting A's. My parents wanted me to get A's, and I wanted to be a good boy. I wasn't really handsome. I had a really bad complexion in high school. And I wasn't an athlete, as you probably could guess. And so there was nothing else for me to do but be good at school, you know. So I studied all the time, and I got straight A's, and my parents were happy. And so when I started doing Zen, you know, I treated it like school. I wanted to get A's in Zen practice, you know. So when I began to go in to see Genki Roshi and began to report on my practice, and he kept saying, "No, I'm sorry, that's not it. You're not there. Sorry." He'd ring the bell. It was like getting F's on my report card, you know. So existentially, this was very difficult for me. You know, I wanted to be a brilliant Zen student, and I was like a Zen dunce or Zen failure. I didn't know why I didn't quit, except that, as I said, you know, when I would sit down and on the cushion and get off the cushion, I would feel better. You know, I think unconsciously I was sticking with it because it was helping me. But, you know, my deep unconscious mind was feeling better. On an unconscious level, my life was opening up because I was encountering the moment without all this mediation. But my conscious mind was still trapped in all these assumptions. You know, this is very much how Zen practice works. You know, so your conscious mind is constantly full of self-doubt, self-loathing, anxiety, you know, skepticism, whatever, you know. You have your dramas playing in your head. But meanwhile, you know, on the cushion, you're really transforming yourself. It's like you're the last one to know, in a way. You know, conscious mind is like the last to get the news. So, you know, I'm going to sit. At first I would go to sit once a week at the Zen Center, and then I would go to sit 5 days a week. You know, at that time we had practice every morning. And I would go to sit every morning, and it was really changing me. I was really becoming a better person. You know, after about 5 or 6 years of Zen training, it suddenly occurred to me that I had not been depressed in a long time. You know, I hadn't noticed it. But after about 5 or 6 years, I suddenly realized, you know, it's been a long time since I felt like that. You know, something was changing inside me on a deeper level than my consciousness. But my consciousness was still worried about the usual stuff. You know, so I was worried about getting F's on my Zen report card. And I was worried about not passing my koan, so to speak. And by the way, there were about 30 of us or 25 of us who all started at the Seattle Zen Center at the same time when Genki Roshi arrived. And we all began to sit together at least once a week, and we began to go to Sesshin together. So we were like this group of people who were all like in the same age group. And we would go to Sesshin, and people would go to Dokusan, you know. And we all, if you know how Dokusan works, people are going in order to meet with the teacher privately. So they get up and leave the room and go to meet the teacher, and then you come and sit back down. And so, you know, you're waiting for your turn to see the teacher, but you might be focusing on your meditation, but sometimes you're noticing, like, when is my turn, when is my turn, when is my turn? So I'm waiting for it to be my turn, and I would notice that people would go into the Dokusan room, and sometimes they would be privately with the teacher for a long period of time. So that probably meant that they were they were doing very well in their koan, or there was some deep exchange. So all of these people would go in, and they'd be with Genki Roshi for a long time, and I'd go in, and I'd be there for like 2 minutes, and he'd ring the bell, and I was out, you know. So that made me feel like I was getting Fs on my Zen report card. And after Sesshin, too, you know, all of these people, you're not supposed to talk about your koan training, but people would be driving home, and they'd be happy and say, yeah, I passed my koan. And I would listen and think, oh my God, you did? You know, so anxious, like, oh my God, I haven't passed my koan, you know. And, this would go on and on. Everybody was passing koans but me. I felt like I would be a 50-year-old Zen student and I would never have passed the breath koan. So all of my phobias and anxieties were in place, right? And I'm sitting on the cushion and I'm supposed to be paying attention to the breath. But on a deeper level, something is opening up. You know, something is changing. Zen is really about activating this deeper part of ourself and using it to liberate ourselves. Why did I come to do Zen in the first place? You know, it wasn't. Something about it spoke to me. And why did I stick with it? You know, it was because even though I felt like a failure at Zen, and even though I was very frustrated, you know, not being able to answer my koan, work through these questions, and even though I felt like I wasn't accomplishing anything, on a deeper level, I was really coming to life. I was really opening up. You know, and people would say to me, you know, I remember after about doing Zen practice for about 5 or 6 years, you know, going home and people in my family would say, you seem like such a different person. You're so much more relaxed. You seem happier. One of the most important lessons you can learn in Zen is that the thinking is not the path to liberation. You know, very important. You know, if you think about Buddhism in terms of its Buddhism as a religion, it's really an interesting thing. You know, really interesting. Because if you read the Bible, for example, you know, you look at something like Laws of Moses. You know, the law isn't is supposed to be. These are the words of God. You know, this is the word of God. These are given to Moses by God. Okay. Or if you look at the teachings of Jesus, you know, this is the word of God, right? Or the word of Jesus, right? You know, basically, if you read the Quran, is actually the word of God, literally. I mean, the Bible is, the first books of the Bible are supposed to have been written by Moses, and then the New Testament is written by the apostles, right? The Quran is literally supposed to have been dictated by God to Muhammad. But Buddhism is really quite different because in our scriptures. The Buddha says things all the time like, these are just ideas, don't take them too seriously. Isn't that interesting? In the Diamond Sutra, which is the most important sutra for the Zen sect, the Buddha says, you know, I'm here to, the Buddha is teaching to liberate all beings. And then at one point in the sutra he says, however, the idea that there is such a thing as liberation is just an idea. And at another point, he says the idea that there are things, beings who need to be liberated, is actually just an idea. And he also, you know, and he goes through and says, all of this is, these are just, don't take these too seriously. They're just ideas. Now, I think that's interesting. You know, there's a fundamental, I think there's an important difference, you know. Somehow Buddhism is saying, look, you know, what you believe is important. It's important to have good beliefs. So, you know, don't kill, that's a good belief. Be kind to others, very important. But on a deeper level, beliefs are not going to liberate you, you know. Beliefs are not ultimately liberating. You know, the Buddhist view is that actually our problem is we get too caught up in these mental structures, in these fantasies which we think are real. And it's somehow, you know, being a really liberated and compassionate person requires us to get free from that instead of holding on to it too tightly. You know, we can look at other cultures and we can see how crazy beliefs can be. You know, so if you read like the history of Europe, you know, every little German boy in Europe would play with little soldiers of German and French soldiers, toy soldiers, and the German boys would dream of conquering France. This was like, you know, every little German boy would dream that someday he would be a great general and he would subdue France, right? And over in France, little French kids would be playing with their toy soldiers and then they would crush the Germans, right? And this would go on, this went on for hundreds of years. You know, if you go to Europe now, you know, you can't tell a German from a Frenchman until they open their mouths, right? It's really not an important distinction. But people were killing for it, you know. So you know, the Buddhist view is, you know, we think that having a new idea is going to be liberating for us, you know. And in a certain way, having a new idea is a good thing, you know. But you know, it's also the case that we really aren't really liberated by what we believe, you know. We need to have good beliefs to a point. They're necessary. But after a while, we get very locked in or very closed in by our beliefs, you know, by our assumptions and what we're told is true. So, you know, you know what the breath is. You know, the breath goes in and the breath goes out. If the O2 goes in, the CO2 goes out. If you begin to really sit deeply with your breath, you will find that it takes you to a place that's quite unlike anything you've ever experienced. You know, the breath is a door into a completely different relationship to the world. That's the truth. You know, once you begin to interact with the world in this way, it's life-changing, you know. Another way to put it is, you know, we are we're surrounded by all these concepts and ideas, and sometimes they make us sick, they make us unhappy, but we think they're real. So, you know, here's an example. My father grew up in New Jersey. My family's from New Jersey, and during World War II, my father got to serve in the military. He was in the Navy. He joined the Navy during World War II. And he left Elizabeth, New Jersey, never to return. Serving in the military for about 25 years, he worked for the Department of Defense. And you might not know this, but in government service, there's something called a GS rating. It's a GS rating. You move up a ladder from like GS4 or something all the way up to like there's these GS20s. And my father was a GS, I think he was a GS 12 or 13. And he wanted to be a GS 20, you know. And later in his life, he would get very depressed because he was still a 13. So I was a little boy, and I would come home, and sometimes my father would be drinking. He developed a drinking problem. because he was depressed that he wasn't a GS20. You know, and I can remember sometimes on a Friday night, my father would be sitting in the living room drinking, and he must have been thinking, you know, what is it about me that I can't be a GS20? What is it, you know? Why not? Well, you know, meantime, you know, if you went outside, you know, the moon was in the sky, the wind was blowing through the trees, you know, crickets were singing. You know, he could have been such a happy man, you know. I mean, it's easy for me to say because I wasn't in his mental space, but he could have been so happy, but he was so unhappy. You know, this is so human, right? So human. You know, so often we get trapped in these concepts and these ideas that are totally unreal, and we can't get out. You know, my father was trying to get out by drinking. You know, sometimes people take drugs, people do risk-taking behaviors and things like that. You know, one way to think about Zen is it's all about cutting through these layers of illusion or, you know, half-truth, and opening up the world as it is right here and now. You know, this is Zen. And so, you know, in some ways, ideas, you know, they're necessary. It's good to have, you know, thou shalt not kill. Please don't kill. This is very important. But in another sense, you know, ideas don't really liberate you. Even the idea of Buddha doesn't really liberate you. You know, just believing in Buddha doesn't solve anything. It doesn't solve anything. You know, I was just reading in the newspaper yesterday, it said, there's a new study, it said religious people, actually there's probably higher rates of depression among religious people. And I believe it. You know, and I think part of the problem is that you know, part of what we think of as religion is finding a belief that you can hold on to tightly. It's like, finally, I have something I can hold on to, the truth, right? And that desire to get to truth and know it and hold it is so deeply ingrained in the human being. You know, and even Buddhists do this. You know. You'll meet many Buddhists who are like Bible-thumping Buddhists, or I guess it would be Sutra-thumping Buddhists, you know. You know, they'll tell you, you know, the Buddha said this. The Buddha says, oh, gosh, you know, please stop. You know, if somebody dies, they go, impermanence. Yeah. Impermanence, all is impermanent, you know. It's like, shut up! There's a very famous Zen master, you know, his teacher died, and his students came in to see him, and he was sobbing. And the student said, "Why are you crying? You're a Zen teacher. You're not supposed to." He said, "Listen, when I want to cry, I'll cry. You know. So don't you think there would be something wrong with you if you didn't cry when the person you love disappeared from the world? You know, that person, a person who was stony and unmoving, wouldn't be admirable." They would be dead. So it's possible that the solution to our problems isn't finding a set of beliefs that we can cling to that explain everything. You know, maybe that's a stage in our development and our maturing process. But really, our problem is we get too locked into this world of concepts and ideas. And, you know, we become so invested that we can't be free. We can't be in the moment. We can't be open. You know, Zen belongs to a larger movement in Buddhism called the Mahayana. And the Mahayana begins as kind of a reaction to earlier Buddhism, which was very like fundamentalist Buddhism, kind of. So the early Buddhists mapped out like steps towards enlightenment. You know, step one is this, step two is this, step three is this, step four is this, step five is this, step six. And it makes you not want to be enlightened. It's so boring, you know. So the Mahayana view is, look, you know, when you create steps like that, when you create stages and so on, you're just distancing yourself from the moment all over again. You're just creating another set of concepts. You know, you're just creating another set of concepts that distance you from the experience of enlightened mind. So you know, the Zen method is constantly to cut away at our concepts and expectations and plunge us back into uncertainty and openness. And this is how people have Daikensho, Great Awakening. You know, a good Zen teacher is constantly pushing the student back into uncertainty. You know, there was a very famous Zen teacher named Sung San, Korean teacher. And whenever he was asked a question, he'd just say, "I don't know. You know, I don't know. I don't know." And people, you know, began to realize that he was really doing them a great service. He was saying, don't look to ideas. What could he possibly... If somebody said, what is Buddha? You know, somebody could say, well, Buddha is really the phenomenological manifestation of primal awareness. You know, that doesn't change anything. You know, you still feel the same way, right? You haven't gotten any closer knowing that, right? So, you know, if somebody says, what stage are you in your meditation practice? You could say, I'm at stage 3. But that doesn't really tell you anything, right? It doesn't liberate you in any way. You can say, oh boy, I've made it to stage 3. See, so the Zen view is that all, you know, humans create concepts the way oysters secrete a shell. So our work in Zen is constantly to cut away at these concepts we're always forming. And we cut away, cut away, cut away, and then we have these glimpses of the moment. Fresh glimpses of the moment. And it's when that happens, when you cut away, the boundary between yourself and the world disappears and you just feel like 100% alive. And you have this wonderful sense of openness and connection. And Zen, Zen is a matter of going through this process again and again and again. So you cut away the concepts and you have an opening up. And then you close it up, being the oyster you are. And then you cut away the concepts, and there's an opening. And then you close it up. And the teacher just keeps cutting away, cutting away, cutting away. But little by little, you know, you change. You become more open, more relaxed, more trusting, more compassionate. And eventually, sooner or later, you know, there's we use this word in Zen called Daikensho, Great Awakening. And Great Awakening means, you know, you have a decisive psychological transformation. You know, you open that up and it never quite gets closed again. You know. We don't have our... At Sesshin, we have a little statue on the altar of Manjushri. Manjushri. Now, you know, there are probably sutra-thumping Buddhists who believe that Manjushri is real, but we Zen people think Manjushri is an aspect of ourselves. So Manjushri is the Bodhisattva of enlightened wisdom, you could say. And we Zen people on our altar at Sesshin, we have a little statue of Manjushri, the Bodhisattva of, you could say, transcendental wisdom. And Manjushri's holding a sword in his hand, right? And you might think, that's odd. You know, I thought Buddhism was a religion of peace. But Manjushri has his sword in his hand. And you might think, what is that sword all about? That is the sword that cuts through conceptualization, that cuts through culture, it cuts through ideas, it cuts through language, using our powers of meditation, you could say, using mushin, our ability to enter a state of blankness or emptiness. So Manjushri's on the altar for a reason. The method of Zen is cutting away at concept formation in order to encounter the moment in its immediacy and freshness. So this is the sword of Manjushri is mu, is emptiness. You know, if you keep watching the breath, if you keep practicing Zen, sooner or later you're going to encounter a state in which your mind is absolutely blank. and there's the concept formation stops. I swear that this will happen to you if it hasn't already. It might just happen for a split second. But this is, we Zen people believe this is the door to liberation. You know, it is possible actually to stop concept formation or to find the place where concept formation does not happen. So your mind is a big place. There's a place in your mind, within your awareness, where there is no conceptualization. So saying that we stop it isn't quite right. Actually, there's a blankness in your mind right now. If you just look at your mind, you can see it. If you look carefully and you're very still. So, Daibai asked Basso, what is Buddha? Basso said, look at your mind at this moment. Look at your mind at this very moment. Mumon's comment, if you directly grasp Basso's meaning, you wear the Buddha's clothes, you eat the Buddha's food, you speak the Buddha's words, you do the Buddha's deeds. That is, you are the Buddha. However, alas, Daibai misled not a few people into taking the mark on the scale for the weight itself. How could he realize that even mentioning the word Buddha should make us rinse out our mouths for 3 days? A man of understanding hears if a man of understanding hears anyone say this mind is Buddha, he will cover his ears and rush away. In other words, as soon as we cut away the concept, we form a new concept. But just keep cutting away, keep cutting away. Mumon's verse, the blue sky and the bright day. No more searching around. Mind is fundamentally concept free. What is Buddha, you ask? With money in your pocket, you've just stolen money and you declare yourself innocent.